bands were always playing, you know, playing shows together. It was an amazing place to be, you know, and a lot got done at that place. Legendary studio.
And Pooch.
I had bands like one of my first is Johnny Thunders used to rehearse there. And his band would, you know, fortunately, I would book it with his management because he would never even show up for his rehearsals. His band would show up, but he wouldn't show up. But at least the band was well rehearsed when they played. Yeah.
You guys have played some amazing gigs. Like, you played with Dinosaur Jr. at the Roxy, and you're going to be playing with Rocky Erickson coming up. Those are some interesting gigs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, and we actually backed up when we played the Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans in 2012. We actually backed up Ty Wagner, who didn't have a band, you know. So the promoter, Ira Padnos, the guy who puts on the Ponderosa Stomp, said, "Hey," he just called up and said, "By the way, can you guys learn a couple of his songs and come back up the stage for him?" And we said, "Yeah, sure." I mean, Ty Wagner, we didn't know he was still alive, you know.
Well, you're coming to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada on November 5th to the Cobalt. You are called The Sloth. We're speaking here to Mike and Pooch from The Sloth. Thanks for phoning in to the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show. Really appreciate it. We're going to end right now with Makin' Love. Anything you want to say about Makin' Love right here, the original version from 1965 and new Sloth on Burger Records. What can you say about Makin' Love, Mike?
Yes, we actually re-recorded a new version of Makin' Love on the Burger Lollipop Records CD and cassette that is now available on both their websites. We'll be bringing some copies with us to the Cobalt Room, you know, and if anyone's interested in a signed copy, you know, we come see us after the show.
But you got to give.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I just want to give a shout-out to Ray. We didn't even talk about Ray, our drummer, who's been another guy who's been through a ton of bands and stuff like that. So, you know, I just want to make sure he gets a little a little love here as well.
And, Pooch, how about the Flipside Archives? Is that ever going to be digitized and up on the web, the amazing Flipside fanzine archives?
I think Holly did a little of that. I actually donated about 50 copies and a bunch of ephemera to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I noticed when I was in their library there, they had a huge poster, a huge mural up with like Bo Diddley and the Clash and the Beatles and all, and right in the middle was a flip side with the Minutemen on it. So I donated a lot of things to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for the, you know, and I think any fanzines should send their stuff there. So, you know, it is there. But as far as the digitized, no, I think Holly tried to do that. It might be up there a little bit. There's so much. You download a ton of stuff that way. So it would be nice if something nice came out of it.
Were you the first person to interview the Germs?
We're the first. We were one of the first. Yeah, maybe we're the first to interview them. Yeah. I know Al was really into the Germs a great deal. And I remember, you know, it was funny now that, like, Pat Smear gets, like, these, you know, the Foo Fighters are huge. So I think and we talked about them in the first issue of Flipside with Kim Fowley on the back of the first issue of Flipside, you know? But yeah, I think we were possibly the first to interview the Germs and all those bands that came out back then, you know, the Bags and X and all these other bands, you know, the Weirdos and the Dickies and Zeros and all that.
Well, thanks so much, Mike and Pooch. Anything else you want to say to the people out there before we kick into Makin' Love by The Sloth?
Yes, something I do want to say. I just want to say, personally, it's a real pleasure to be playing with people in this band that I've known for years. I mean, I knew, like, as you heard me say, I've known Pooch since the 70s. I've known Ray Heron, our drummer, from the early 80s. He used to be in a band called Paul Warren and Explorer. They were... Paul came out of Detroit. You know, I was playing with a Detroit resident, Jamie James, in the Kingbees. I played with another Detroiter, Rick James, in a band, 60s band called Salt and Pepper. So, you know, it's just it's weird how all this Detroit stuff, you know, came into my life. But anyway, it's really cool to have guys, you know, to work with that you've known for decades, you know, and that's just part of the
it's true.
The, enjoyment of it all.
Oh, by the way, if you want to see Mike in a movie, he was in the King Bees, and they did the Idolmaker. And he's in that movie. So he's got his film thing going, too.
Or we can go to the Tammy Show.
Oh, that's yeah, true. You could do that.
Screen grabs. You know. Well, thanks so much, Mike and Pooch, of The Sloths, coming to Vancouver November 5th to the Cobalt. Here's Making Love from 1965. And please keep on rocking in the free world. And doot, doot, a loot, do.
Doot, doot.
I look and do you no harm. I wanna hold you in my arms. I gotta kiss you, gonna hold you tight. I wanna be with you all night, making love. Making love. Good, good, good love, baby. Making love. Oh girl, don't put me down. Got the time, just mess around. Got the joy, can't conceal it. Babe, babe, do you feel it? You're gonna make me feel so fine. I'll be with you on time, making love. Making love, baby. I'll feel so good. Ain't never gonna stop. When you come into my arms and feel my hugging, and you feel my kissing, then baby, you better know just how much you've been missing. Making love. Making love. Only one thing I wanna do. Baby, baby, making love to you. I ain't looking to do you no harm. I wanna hold you in my arms. I gonna kiss you, gonna hold you tight. I'm gonna be with you all now, making love. Making love. Making love all day and all night, baby. Give me that good loving. Good, 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 good loving, baby. Give me that good loving, baby. Making love now. Good loving, good, good, good.
I got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking for one.
Discorder magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
CITR and Stomp Records proudly present The Real Mackenzies live at the Rickshaw, Friday, November 13th. With extra special guests, The Brains, The Isotopes, Lost Kung Fu Monkeys, and Rude City Riot. Come celebrate Stomp Records' 20th anniversary in style with good music, good friends, and great times. Hit up stomprecords.com for more info, music, and swag.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't
can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow across the clouds, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making
it. You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, October 23rd. It's Eminem on the radio. I'm Michael Ruffalo.
And I'm Megan Devlin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:13 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have our science and tech update with Marco.
We also have a sports segment from News 101 correspondent Leo Colo. Finally, we have an episode of Talking Radical Radio, opposing the uranium industry and nuclear colonization in Saskatchewan with Scott Ney.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, a UBC professor helps find a new giant tortoise species. Biology professor Michael Russolo was part of a team of international scientists who identified a new species of giant tortoise. The species was discovered on Ecuador's Galapagos Islands. Until now, it was assumed the two tortoise populations on Santa Cruz Island were of the same species. Naming the new species will help increase protection efforts, according to Yale University's Adalgisa Cacón, who says, quote, "Its low numbers, limited geographic range, and reduced genetic diversity make it vulnerable. As a newly recognized species, it will now receive the attention it needs to ensure its survival." Russolo heads the Ecological and Conservation Genomics Laboratory at UBC's Okanagan campus. He first began working on this project when he was a postdoctoral fellow at Yale University in 2005. Russolo said, quote, "It has been a privilege to work with this international team that now includes academics and in-country specialists and managers on four continents." The findings were published online in October 21st edition of the journal PLOS 1.
In local news, black community representatives sparked debate at City Council on Wednesday over the proposed removal of the Georgia and Dunsmuir viaducts. A passionate appeal from Stephanie Allen urged councillors to recall the razzing of Hogan's Alley, a once cultural hotbed for the black community. The construction of the viaducts in the 1970s devastated the artistic, social, and cultural networks of the city's largest black community. Allen called upon the city's, quote, end quote, obligation to address past unjust actions and is advocating for the plan to, quote, facilitate collaborative consultation with past Hogan's Alley residents. The October 6th city staff report recommends tearing down the viaducts and building an interconnected street network and increased park space. The cost of the project is estimated at $200 million with revenue sources yet to be confirmed. Over 30 speakers were present at the meeting, including representatives from the city planner, the condo developer, and the business community. A vote of the fate of the project is expected on October 27th after hearing the remaining speakers. Howie of Tears deleted emails to be investigated by the RCMP. In May 2015, Tim Duncan, a former staff at the Ministry of Transportation, alleged that more than a dozen emails were deleted in response to a Freedom of Information request. The request of information was connected to the notorious Highway of Tears. Now, a reported BC's Privacy Commissioner Elizabeth Denham reveals that Freedom of Information laws were routinely ignored by staff in Premier Christy Clark's office. The report revealed that a Transportation Ministry staffer lied under oath when he denied that he had deleted emails. It also found that Clark's deputy chief of staff deleted emails on a daily basis in direct breach of Freedom of Information laws. This report follows claims of a government cover-up made in May by First Nations tribal councillor Mavis Erickson. According to her, the government, quote, wants this whole story to go away. At least 18 women have gone missing or murdered along the Highway 16, the route that connects Prince George and Prince Rupert in northern BC. 17 of these cases remain unsolved.
In national news, the Liberal Party of Canada will be forming the new government after winning a majority of seats in the Canadian federal election this Monday. 184 Liberal candidates were elected, up from 34 seats, giving the party more than the 170 seats it needed for a majority. The Conservatives, however, dropped to 99 seats from 166. The NDP likewise dropped to 44 seats from 103. The Bloc Québécois elected 10 candidates, up from the 4 in the last election. Finally, the Green Party maintained its seat in Parliament as Elizabeth May was re-elected in the riding of Saanich Gulf Islands. The Conservative Party's defeat led Stephen Harper to announce that he will step down from party leadership but will still represent his riding in Parliament. Likewise, Gilles Duceppe, the leader of the Bloc Québécois, announced Thursday that he is leaving the leadership of the Bloc. Duceppe lost his own riding to the NDP. Justin Trudeau and Thomas Mulcair, for their part, were re-elected in Papineau and Outremont, respectively. Voter turnout improved, increasing to more than 68% from 61% in 2011, but results still failed to accurately reflect votes. Trudeau's Liberal government won a majority of seats, with only 39.5% of the vote. Canada's voting system, known as first-past-the-post, is responsible for these so-called false majorities. Trudeau pledged on the campaign trail to make this week's vote, quote, the last unfair election. He promised to look into other electoral systems that are more representative than what Canada currently has. A citizen initiative website called TrudeauMeter.ca was created this week to keep track of Trudeau's campaign promises, such as changing the electoral system. And sex abuse investigation of Quebec police underway after reports First Nations women have been abused. CBC's French language investigative program uncovered cases of sexual violence against Aboriginal women in the small town, Quebec town of Val d'Or. The program featured several women describing instances where they were picked up by police cars while appearing intoxicated. The officers drove them out of town and left them to walk alone. Home alone in the cold. Several women spoke publicly about being paid by officers to perform sex acts and were physically assaulted. Edith Cloutier, director of the local Native Friendship Center, is calling it, quote, a national tragedy. Quebec's Minister of Public Safety, Lise Thoreau, held back tears at a press conference this morning and announced the transfer of the investigation to Montreal police.
In international news, one dead and three wounded in Tennessee state shooting. A gunman fatally shot one person and injured three others over a dice game Thursday night at Tennessee State University. Metro Nashville police spokesman Don Aaron said of the incident, quote, this was an isolated shooting incident in a courtyard. There were never, we believe, any other students in danger in dormitories or elsewhere on campus. 19-year-old Cameron Selman was fatally wounded. Three 18-year-old female students who were passing by the courtyard were also hit. Two of the women were treated for non-life-threatening injuries, while the third did not require hospitalization. The campus went into lockdown this morning as police investigated. Police do not yet have a description of the shooter, but they hope witnesses who filmed the incident will come forward. The shooting happened hours after the school celebrated Founders Day, the 103rd anniversary of TSU. This also comes only a week after another man opened fire at a party just off campus where three people were wounded. Hungarian camera woman who was fired for viral video of her tripping and kicking Syrian refugees plans to sue. Petra Laszlo was filming for Hungarian TV channel N1 TV back in September when she was seen tripping a man, sprinting with a child in his arms, and kicking two children. After the footage went viral, she was fired from the TV station. Laszlo is currently under criminal investigation and is due to face trial in December. She told Russian newspaper Izvestia that she plans to file the lawsuits once her trial is over. She intends to sue Facebook for failing to take down negative and threatening content directed towards her when the video went viral. She also claims that the social media site deleted groups that supported her. Laszlo will also file a lawsuit against Osama Abdel Musen al-Gadab, the man who she's seen tripping. Al-Gadab is alleged to have shifted his testimony for trial, having initially blamed police for the incident before the footage went viral, according to Laszlo. In her interview with Izvestia this week, the former camerawoman said she's considering moving her family to Russia after the trial, as she is unlikely to find work in Hungary again. Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
El show de Leo Ramírez, lunes 4 a 5 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM CITR. Show Monday 4 to 5 p.m. at 101.9 FM CITR.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to M&M on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, the latest from the world of science and technology with our Science and Tech update with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco with your latest science and technology news. The first two stories are about the weather and El Nino. In the first story, the headline reads, "Wet but warm winter, strong El Nino to usher in lots of rain." Here in North America, in the Pacific Northwest, that's the U.S., and in Canada, we're in the Pacific Southwest. But the West Coast will be hit by a wet and warmer than average winter thanks to a strong El Nino brewing in the Pacific Ocean, which will probably persist through the winter, forecasters said in an October 15 news briefing. We won't be able to officially rank the strength of this El Nino until it peaks out and ends, but the expectation is it will be among the three strongest, with the other strong El Nino events occurring in 1997 to 1998 and 1982 to 1983. So says Mike Halpert, the deputy director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in America. The El Nino is a strong subtropical weather pattern, and this will boost the odds for rainfall and warm temperatures across Canada, the southern U.S., and the eastern seaboard, including the drought-stricken regions in California. The El Nino, though, might have a dangerous side to it. Because of the drought, a lot of the vegetation in California is very sparse now, so it won't be able to absorb the rain as it might have been absorbed. But even if California is inundated with rain, the state's water woes won't be limited in one season. El Nino is a weather pattern that occurs when warm water from western tropical Pacific Ocean shifts towards the equatorial coast of South America. This nudges the tropical storms eastward. because the moisture-laden air causes thunderstorm and accumulates a great amount of water from the oceans, these will dump a lot of water on us. They tend to bring high precipitation, thunderstorm, and warm weathers to North America, so we should look forward to a warm and wet winter. The counterpart of El Niño is La Niña. They are part of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO cycle. This season, there's a strong El Niño in the cards, but this doesn't guarantee warm and soppy forecast or weather. Other more unpredictable climate changes, such as the North Atlantic and Arctic oscillations, as well as local weather events, can also affect winter storms. However, based on current status, a 60% chance for warmer weather than average exists across North America. Meanwhile, the Rockies, Great Lakes, Northern Alaska, and Hawaii expect to face drier than average conditions. In our next story, Borneo is on fire. Asian countries near the equator are in an extreme drought, one of the more predictable impacts of El Niño. Unpredictable impacts of El Niño. The worst forest fires, they've been burning for quite a few years now, out of control on the islands of Borneo and Sumatra. On October 14th, an image from NASA's multi-angle imaging spectral radiometer, MISR satellite, shows a section of the Indonesian side of Borneo. The blanket of smoke covers much of the image, and it extends to Malaysia and Singapore. For us, that would be an equivalent of a smoke cloud reaching from Vancouver all the way to Los Angeles. There are 9 different cameras on the MISR, and they form multiple images from different Canadas that can be processed together to obtain estimates of the height of the smoke clouds. The smoke clouds are estimated to be 1.2 miles or 2,000 meters high above the land surface. It has the potential to affect air quality not only locally, but as far as thousands of miles away. So those are 2 stories about the weather. Now in the 3rd story, magnets might unlock paralyzed arm after stroke. Stroke is one of the leading causes of death in the U.S. and Canada. So says the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in America. Stroke occurs when blood flow from the brain is cut off, starving the brain cells of oxygen. People suffer stroke on the face and many physical and emotional hurdles towards a long recovery. But now there might be a glimmer of hope with one of the most common stroke symptoms, which is partial arm paralysis, which leaves affected arms or limbs frozen to a person's side like a broken wing. Researchers are now using strong pulses of magnetic energy to select areas of the brain. This is called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, to probe and identify undamaged, untapped brain regions so they can take over and execute the arm movement. The stimulation does not outright cure stroke patients of their paralysis, but it does improve their function to limbs that were once not useful at all. The researchers try to teach the brain how to move the paralyzed arm using this magnetic stimulation called TMS. The majority of strokes are ischemic. This means caused by a blood clot in a vessel. Only 15% of the strokes are hemorrhagic, which is caused by a burst in a blood vessel. But the hemorrhagic accounts for 40% of all stroke deaths. Regardless of the stroke type, 90% of stroke sufferers will have mild to severe paralysis of a limb on one side of their body, such as an arm, a wrist, a leg, or an ankle. Standard treatments for this paralysis have not been successful before. In 2012, researchers from the University of Victoria in British Columbia discovered that strength training for stroke patients was useful when physicians targeted the stronger side, when people did exercises on the stronger side, this somehow strengthened their weaker side. But still, for many stroke patients, no amount of exercise can defrost their frozen limb. But now with this magnetic radiation, it could. There was a study where half the patients had severe impairment where they could not move their limbs. The other half had mild impairment. Researchers found in the ones with the mild impairment, the areas of the brain close to the damaged area sometimes took over the functioning of the arm movement. But the magnetic therapy did not work very well in these patients. But with the ones with severe impairment, the patients would move a limb on cue and a magnetic pulse would be applied to the damaged area. And there was great improvement because pathways could be stimulated to help the stroke patients remap their brain. So the researcher, Dr. Harrington, said brain regions immediately around the damaged area in the severely impaired cases of stroke could take over and started to move the limb. The researchers hope that with a repeated stimulation, they can teach the brain to control the impaired arm. So I'll try to keep you updated on this story in the next section. And in our last story, we are chasing wormholes. Believe it or not, in the world of physics and astronomy, the study of wormholes is now in vogue again. Science fiction literature is full of stories with tunnels in space-time, known as wormholes, and we have thought they are used for time travel. But how much fact lies with the fiction? The answer is more than you might think. Scientists are now looking at ways to use traversable wormholes, if they exist, to travel faster than speed of light, to time travel, or to travel to other spaces, places in the universe. Traversable wormholes are hyperspace tunnels, and their main area is called the throat that connects two remotely distant regions in the universe, two different universe, or two different periods of time. So we could travel to time if we could find the wormhole. Dr. Davies from the University of California, Berkeley he specializes in field space-time, and where he uses Einstein's equation of relativity to think about the possibilities of traversing wormholes or using warp drives or time machines. They are thinking about building a wormhole, but that is a difficult thing. The foremost authority in wormholes is Professor Kip Thorne from the University of California, the California Institute of Technologies. He says, and quote, "Scientists have not yet come up with an agreed upon way that wormhole can form because we have never detected a wormhole before. But Thorne has shown that even if a wormhole appeared, it would likely collapse before an object or person can pass through it. One of the myths about wormholes is they can be found in black holes, but this is not true because black holes, if we got near them, would crunch us to death in an instant. But wormholes do not have this huge gravitational repulsive force. What scientists believe, though, exotic material like dark energy or dark matter is needed to form a wormhole. Scientists haven't directly detected dark matter or dark energy, which makes up 95% of the mass of the universe, but they indirectly are measuring its effect. A professor, Ali Avgan, from Eastern Mediterranean University in Cyprus, says that where dark matter lies, he has proven through his research that wormholes could exist if with the dark matter. He ran simulations showing wormholes in dense regions of dark matter found in galactic halos would satisfy the physical requirements to make this tunnel. But it is only a mathematical proof, so don't get your hopes up yet. This is Marco. You have listened to the latest in science and technology.
Thank you, Marco. That was wonderful news. Now we have a segment, a sports segment, from News 101 correspondent Leonardo Colo.
against Mount Royal in Calgary. The T-Birds will face the Manitoba Bison. And welcome to this week's edition of your sports segment on News 101, bringing you the best sporting coverage from a student perspective. If you're on campus tonight, you might not want to miss the UBC Thunderbirds women's hockey team returning to their home building after a two-week road trip in Alberta with 4 wins in 4 games against Mount Royal and Calgary. The T-Birds will face the Manitoba Bisons at 7 p.m. on Friday and at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Both games will be played at the Doug Mitchell Thunderbird Sports Center. Last time these teams faced each other, UBC fell 2-1 at the hands of the Bisons in Game 3 of the Canada West semifinals and was eliminated from the postseason. Pay attention to forwards Kathleen Calhoun, who scored 3 times during the road trip, and Nicole Saxby, who netted 2 goals, as well as goaltender Samantha Langford, who only let in 1 shot out of the 28 she faced last week. In professional baseball, the Toronto Blue Jays are trying another miraculous comeback to get in the World Series. By the time this segment is aired, Game 6 of the ALCS will already be underway at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, as pending free agent ace David Price looks to snap a 0-7 postseason record. The Jays are down 3-2 in the best-of-seven series and need to win both games on the road if they want to face the New York Mets, who swept the Chicago Cubs, to make their first Fall Classic appearance since 2000 and to prove that Marty McFly was wrong. Yes, the Cubs were swept by the Mets on the exact same day Back to the Future's protagonists predicted they would win the World Series.
I'm $100. Will you help save the clock tower?
Sorry, no.
Come on, kid. That's an important historical landmark.
Look, some other time.
Lightning struck that thing 60 years ago.
Wait a minute. Cubs win World Series. Against Miami?
Yeah, it's something, huh? Who would have thought? 100-1 shot. I wish I could go back to the beginning of the season, put some money on the Cubs.
I just meant Miami. What did you just say?
I said I wish I could go back to the beginning of the season, put some money on the Cubbies.
Meet the Mets, step right up and greet the Mets. Bring your kiddies, bring your wife.
Speaking of the Mets, this 2015 edition of the Miracle Mets by far exceeded expectations to make a surprising World Series appearance. Led in October by their outstanding starting rotation starring Jacob deGrom, Noah Syndergaard, Matt Harvey and Steven Matz, and with second baseman Daniel Murphy inserting his name into history books after being the first player ever to homer in 6 straight postseason games, when put it into perspective, the season wasn't supposed to be great. During spring training, starting power pitcher Zach Wheeler torn his UCL and had to undergo Tommy John surgery to repair the elbow, meaning he was ruled out for the whole season. Expectations lowered. Furthermore, the Mets play in the NL East, where their current division rivals, the Washington Nationals, were the clear-cut favorites to win not only the division, but also the National League due to their recent playoff appearances, and for having Bryce Harper, signing current AL Cy Young winner Max Scherzer from Detroit, and for having the best starting rotation according to the experts, with Max Scherzer, Jordan Zimmermann, Steven Strasburg, Doug Fister and Gio Gonzalez on opening day. This later proved to be untrue, as the Nationals had an underwhelming and tragic season, and the Mets ran away with the division and proved to the experts that their rotation was the best in baseball. Regardless if the Mets are going to win the World Series, baseball proves again that predicting the game is a silly exercise. You can't predict baseball, Susan. You just can't.
Meet the Mets. Meet the Mets. Step right up and greet the Mets.
101, I'm Leonardo.
Thank you, Leo. Now we have segment 3, Opposing the Uranium Industry and Nuclear Colonization in Saskatchewan, with Scott Ney of Talking Radical Radio.
My name is Scott Ney, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people that are facing many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I will be speaking with Candace Paul. Industrial activity that requires the mining and use of significant amounts of radioactive material has been around since at least the middle of the 20th century. Such activity inevitably results in waste that is no longer useful but that continues to be radioactive and therefore dangerous. Despite the many decades we have traveled into the nuclear era, there remains no solution that has been rigorously proven to be safe and that is broadly accepted for dealing with waste that, in the case of uranium, will continue to emit radiation for billions of years. Uranium mining arrived in northern Saskatchewan in the 1970s, along with a complicated mix of embrace and resistance from local communities, which are mostly Cree, Dene, and Métis, with a handful of settler folk mixed in. Then, in 2011, it emerged that the leadership of three communities had signed up to be considered as the potential location for a radioactive waste storage facility. The Committee for Future Generations was soon born as a collective vehicle for residents to oppose any such facility. They did extensive research and public education. They participated in public hearings, meetings, and regulatory processes. They did a protest walk to Regina. And, ultimately, they succeeded in ensuring that none of the three communities in the territory were chosen for the waste facility. But uranium mining continues, and the territory is blanketed with claims where companies will be doing exploration that could well end up in one, two, or many new mines. Paul talks with me about the Committee for Future Generations organizing so far, about their significant concerns about the health, social, and environmental impacts of the uranium industry, which she encapsulates as nuclear colonization, and about their next steps in working towards a safe, healthy, decolonized future for northern Saskatchewan. We spoke by Skype.
Good day, I'm Candace Paul from English River First Nation in northern Saskatchewan, and I am the outreach coordinator for the Committee for Future Generations. We're a group of volunteers who have taken on the task of educating our people in our province and nationally, internationally as well, on the state of the uranium and nuclear industry in Saskatchewan. We're in northwestern Saskatchewan. The mines are about 300 kilometers northeast of us as the crow flies. All of the communities in the northwest have people that are flown into the mines to work. The nuclear waste situation would have been within that same distance of us, but it would have been passing through our particular community for sure. There's about 37,000 people in the region, and we're mostly Cree, Dene, Métis, with a few settler people. I really didn't get involved. I knew about the uranium industry. I knew about nuclear bombs because growing up as a child, we were told that if an alarm went off, and there were alarm drills in the communities, even in rural communities back then during the Cold War, that we were supposed to go under our desks at school. That was it. And I thought that was kind of really dumb. Even as a kid, I thought that was kind of a dumb plan. But my husband, growing up in the north here, where the uranium mines started to make an impact and then started impacting the people, has been involved for quite some time. He was involved in some camps and roadblocks in the late 70s and early 80s to try and stop the yellow cake trucks and inform the drivers of the dangers and the risks. He also was part of a group of people at that time that were trying to make awareness across all of North America on that. And then for many years, we spent a lot of years living in the bush, building our own home, and we were kind of out of touch with things. But back in 2011, there was an announcement. We were working in a school at the time. There was an announcement in a publication that comes to schools for children on current events that English River First Nation, that's our band, the neighboring town of Pinehouse, the Métis community, and the town of Creighton in northeastern Saskatchewan had all decided to sign up to learn about storing nuclear waste. And in the same article, there was another story about Fukushima triple meltdowns.
And just in case listeners aren't aware, Fukushima is the location of a major nuclear power plant meltdown that occurred in Japan in 2011.
My students wanted to learn about this, so I had them do research. And when they started doing research, they got so involved that they didn't even take breaks. They didn't take a break in the morning, noon, or in the afternoon. And after that, we had a discussion period. And what they said to me was, what's the matter with the adults? Don't they know this is crazy? You can't spend money if you're dead. And they said, how far away do we have to move to be safe? If something went wrong with this, the answer is there's no place to move. And at that point, I saw it as my duty as an adult to address this for them, because they had that expectation that we should. That's where I became more heavily involved. And since that time, every day I'm doing something on this issue.
So how did the Committee for Future Generations get started?
When some of our neighbors in Beauvais had participated in a elders conference in Pinehouse, there was a discussion that was supposed to be about what to do about youth suicide, because it is a problem in our region. And all of a sudden, about halfway through the conversation, a person stood up and started writing on a flip chart, NWMO. Nobody really knew what that was. So he said, this is Nuclear Waste Management Organization, and this is the answer to our youth suicides. We need all this money from this organization. We got to store nuclear waste so that we can stop youth suicides. We can put in programs for that. 10 of the elders got up and walked out because they knew this was not right. So our neighbor was pretty upset and came home and told his wife, and together they called and informed a whole bunch of people, including us. And within about 2 weeks, we had arranged a forum where we invited somebody who knew a lot more about the uranium and nuclear business, Dr. Jim Harding, to come up and explain to us exactly what it would be that we're facing. They also invited Nuclear Waste Management Organization to come, and they refused. But they did get some materials that are been left in the kiosks in the communities with a PowerPoint display that they had on CD-ROM, and it was presented. There were 200 people that came from 12 different communities across the north, and there was a resolution made that we should oppose and start a petition to ask for a ban on nuclear waste storage in Saskatchewan. So that is the beginnings of our organization. It's made up of Cree, Métis, Dene, settler people from English River, Beauval, Pinehouse, and the network of people all across the province now. We, at that point, started building the petition and getting signatures, and decisions were made to do a walk against nuclear waste from Pinehouse to the legislature in Regina. That was in the summer of 2011. It took about 3 weeks to do. And we got a lot of good press at the beginning, until we got to Saskatoon. While we were in Saskatoon, Nuclear Waste Management Organization got to the Saskatoon newspaper and wrote an editorial that said that it would be pretty much crazy to not take this deal in an economically deprived region. It was all based on the benefits of economics. That was the push. And there was not a whole lot of information at that time on what the real risks are. So we did months and months and years now of research on what those risks are. When we went to see and participate in meetings and open houses that the Nuclear Waste Management Organization put on, we would ask questions based on trying to see if they're going to tell us everything. And there were so many gaps. And there were times when they didn't have the answers. And it got to the point where the communications officer for their organization didn't know the answer in a meeting, and he turned to me and he said, I bet you know the answer, don't you? And I said, yes, I do. And I can't even remember what the question was. You know, it was pretty blatant. There was so much lack of logic. I think the whole process was really premature. They've been working on trying to find a solution for nuclear waste storage, or what to do with it, for more than 50 years. And they haven't gotten close to coming up with a solution. So the only solution they've got at the moment is to try and store it in a deep geological repository. That means about 500 meters underground. However, their storage system is based on encapsulating the nuclear waste in copper, then steel, then concrete, and then bentonite clay. Right now, they are still in the process of doing the research on how this is going to impact the microbes that live in the bentonite clay. They don't know that. And then we came to the realization, in order for bentonite clay to work as a seal, it has to be wet, which means they're going to have to put water over it. And we asked the question at one of their meetings, okay, since it has to be wet and you have to put water over it, which they hadn't told people, is this not going to make that water radioactive? And they had to admit that it would. So aquifers are going to already get impacted. The other thing is they're still working on a way to seal the hole, and that experiment is taking place in Kinawa, Manitoba, and that experiment's going to be running for another 50 years. So at this point, they don't even know if they can seal the hole, and they don't know whether or not it's going to be permanent, but they would already have nuclear waste stored in a repository before the experiment is over. So really, I don't think there's any possible way that they can really confirm that it's going to seal it for 4.7 billion years, which is the amount of time it's going to be before this stuff is safe around human or living things. There are other methods of storage that they could do. One of the things that some people, including myself, agree with is that it should have rolling stewardship. Look after it above ground where you can monitor it into perpetuity if you have to. Or keep on doing the research. Find out other ways that you can deal with it. But one of the biggest problems is they still want to keep producing it. And I think it's really foolish and irresponsible of the nuclear industry to continue to create nuclear waste when they do not have a real solution. In November 2013, it was announced that English River, First Nation, and Pine House did not make the cut. So they were eliminated from the process. When the reporter that called me interviewed them before he called me, he asked them what the reason was. And they said, well, there was no way that they could get the approval of the region because of the misinformation that our group was spreading around the region. We've been very careful about the information we use. We make sure that it's confirmed, that it's peer-reviewed, that there's physicists, engineers, scientists, doctors that back it up. So it wasn't misinformation. It was just that they couldn't counter it. And they also said that the geology just wasn't suitable enough. In February of this year, it was announced that Creighton, the last remaining community in Saskatchewan that had been looking at it, was eliminated due to geology. But there was strong resistance in Creighton, and we were very much part of that. And there was people that joined our organization, the Committee for Future Generations, from Creighton and Flin Flon. Now we are more involved in what to do about the existing uranium mining and the exploration for new uranium deposits. The entire region south of Lake Athabasca is completely covered with mining claims, exploration claims. That is the traditional hunting territory of the Dene Sinkuni people. There is so much activity going on in northwestern Saskatchewan, north of Lalosh, that people are having a difficult time reaching their hunting and fishing territories because there's camps in the way, there's security gates, there's helicopters flying overhead. When they try to go to their traditional regions, all of the wildlife is being disturbed. And that is a great concern because they were never consulted. There's letters that come out from the Saskatchewan Ministry of the Environment and Resources to 12 stakeholders only. And they consider that they send something out to a Métis local, it's going to get to all the people. They consider that if it goes out to the chairman of a trapper's local, it's going to get to all the people. The problem is, it's not as easy as that, because a lot of them aren't accessible during the period of time. There's a 30-day response time. You've got 30 days from the day it's mailed to respond. And I've seen these permits. They're already approved. Every one of them says that it's going to have low impact on the traditional hunting and gathering rights of the people, but that isn't what the people are seeing. It is having a high impact, and it's going to be worse now because during this past summer, I'm sure you're aware, our entire north was pretty much on fire. Large regions burned through the Let It Burn policy of the Saskatchewan government. So large areas are burnt right to the ground. There is no foliage, nothing left. Many animals perished, and many more animals had to flood into an area where fires didn't have an impact. I can tell you right now, some people cut down a tree and left it overnight, and by morning, the rabbits had stripped it of all green needles. That's how hungry they are. So it's going to be a really hard winter for the animals up here, which means it's going to be a difficult time for the people up here as well, because we still depend on traditional wild food.
So it sounds like one of the key things that the group has done over the years has been research. And I'd imagine that a lot of that research was with respect to things that were hard to find or things that were very technical. Tell me about how you approached doing that research.
First of all, we got a lot of information and a lot of connections through Dr. Jim Harding. We've read his book, Canada's Deadly Secret. We got in contact with a coalition for a Clean Green Saskatchewan who had already previously done research on this and given us as much of their materials as possible. We started doing research on the internet, hours and hours and hours and hours of technical reports, those kinds of things. Pembina Institute, scientists from across the world that have been studying this. We've contacted them. They've shared their information. Dr. Gordon Edwards from Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility came and did presentations to us and came up at our request to give presentations in our communities. So those were some of the ways that we started doing research. We've collected a lot of the research material and put it on our website. However, some of it is being scrubbed off the internet, so a lot of those links no longer function. And that is something that people in the anti-nuclear network have noted. Within the provincial government, there's been a change on access to their websites. You have to put in an application to access information, which I find is really ridiculous and disturbing because we pay these people to do this. Why are we having to go through that to get public information? Why is this information not accessible? When we did presentations, interventions at the relicensing hearings of the Key Lake, Rabbit Lake, and MacArthur River mines, Saskatchewan Environment people were there. A question had been asked by some of our members. This fish and these blueberries that he had in his hand, how do I know that when I'm feeding these to my children, they're not contaminated? And they claim that they do monitoring. And they said that, well, it's available on the website, the Saskatchewan Environment Resources website. Well, most Northerners don't even know that those websites exist. So would they think to look there? And there's a lot of Northern people who don't have computers or computer knowledge. So would they think to do that?
I'd imagine that in the communities in the region, on the one hand, there must be a recognition of the harms that the uranium industry is causing to people and to the planet, but there must also be a pull towards the jobs and the other economic benefits. Tell me about the ways that the tension between the two of those has shown up in the conversations that you've had in the communities in the last number of years.
Tension is the right word because everyone does know and acknowledge that it is a really risky business. A lot of people work in the mines knowing that they're going to eventually get sick. They expect it. Families are disrupted because the people that work in the mines have to go up and fly in and stay a week, and they're away from their families half of the time. We used to be a society that shared everything. When somebody got moose meat, it was shared. Now we are a have and have not society. We have a class system. When the mines opened up, we were promised economic prosperity, but we're not getting it. Most of our communities still only have two stores, and we don't even have things like mechanics. We don't have car dealerships. You can't buy clothing in our communities. So all of the money that they're making goes south. The same time, they know they're hurting their mother. They know that digging this stuff out of the ground because they know the stories of their people. And the old ones had told them and warned them that this stuff had to stay under the ground, that it would make people sick, that it would cause great harm. But They've been forced into a corner. They killed our subsistence economy. They filled us up with the idea that it was no good through the residential school systems and that our lifestyles were no good, yet we had no unemployed people. And now they've made us very dependent. You either take the mining jobs or you go